Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat.
At this rate, we can record a whole year ahead.
We could do that, right? We could set aside a week, a year, where we just fucking go away and just record a year's worth of episodes. But then, like, we'll be so far behind the times.
I mean, that's what the likes of Sarah does, right? And a lot of those other episodic type or series based podcasts do.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, but then they're not topical. A lot of them have seasons as well. So they have like a hiatus. So they have a break. That's what Jamie does with the Modern.net show. That's what Science Versus does. That's obviously what Sarah's doing. I guess that's what everyone sensible does.
Not everyone, but yeah.
Yeah. Look, there are plenty of weekly podcasts as well.
Yeah, weekly's too much.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, the rest of the audience want to hear it weekly and happy to find a sponsor for us.
Yeah.
To be able to pay someone to get the edits done. Actually, one thing we didn't mention at the end of last episode was just a reminder about
BDD Live.
BDD Live. That's right. It's right in February 19, I think, if I'm not mistaken. Which reminds me, I've got some messages to send out, don't I?
Oh, yeah, so do I.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'll get onto that too next week.
I've sent more messages than you have.
One.
By virtue of the fact that the number of messages that I've sent is greater than zero.
That's right.
Not that it's a competition.
No, nothing ever is. But no, really looking forward to that. I think it's going to be good fun.
Yeah, I agree. I'm looking forward to it too.
So I got the date right?
Yes, I believe so.
19th of February, somewhere in the Sydney CBD.
That's right.
We'll keep you posted.
Anyway, how have you been? It's been a while.
Oh, it's been too long. Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. I wish I could have slept in longer.
It's been less than 12 hours.
Yeah, I know. I wish I could have had a bigger sleep in, but no. Up and out the door, took the dog for a
ride. Yeah, so I had about 4 hours sleep.
Oh, fuck. That's a lot less than me.
Yeah, so I was up a bit later than I wanted to be and then got a knock on my door in the middle of the night from Riley because Megan needed help. She was covered in vomit. Not her own, it was Sadie's. But,
poor baby.
Yeah.
That's never fun. So we did record last night to try and squeeze for the early new year.
Have you had any more thoughts about what we spoke about last night?
I haven't had time to think.
Okay. I guess because I did the edit this morning, so I went through it and there's a couple of things that I was listening to and thinking, do you know what? One thing I will say is I actually really enjoyed the conversation a lot more than I did at the time. I think because I was exhausted. But I guess when we were recording and I was thinking to myself, this isn't one of our better episodes, is it? But then listening back through it, it was actually a really good conversation. I really enjoyed listening to it. I don't know if anyone else will, but I guess we'll let history be the judge. But yeah, I really enjoyed it.
I don't know how to take that. You didn't enjoy talking to me, but you enjoyed hearing me?
It wasn't that I didn't enjoy talking to you. It was I was thinking to myself during the conversation that we're rehashing a lot of old material, and I don't know if anyone's going to find this interesting. But then listening back through it, I mean, like the whole conversation opened with this premise that it was your question, right? Which is this statement being made here by this person the same old thing just rebadged under the guise of AI? And the answer is yes. But I mean, I think there is a different and interesting perspective there. Anyway, we don't need to rehash that whole conversation.
No.
There was just a couple of things that I was thinking about. And I don't know, the one thing came to mind, right, was we were talking, one of the things we spoke about was all of the platform vendors shut down their APIs when they realized that people were using them to make their own third-party apps, right, and shortcutting.
Basically taking the eyeballs off their app.
Yeah. So if your feed API means that people can build an app and they don't have to use your app anymore, that means that they lose the ads. It occurred to me, why not just serve ads in the feed? Because that's what they do in their first party apps and their websites. Why not just do it in the API?
Because it would be easier to filter it out.
Yeah, it would.
So I guess it's not guaranteed to actually hit the eyeballs. You know what? I think, was it Feedburner from Google did that? Or that was part of what they were doing?
There's actually a whole bunch of browser plugins that will suppress the ads anyway.
Yes. Yeah. You got ad blockers and whatnot. But I'm just thinking, I think it was Feedburner was basically a way, it's a web feed management service primarily for monetizing RSS feeds.
Oh, okay.
So it would inject the ads into your RSS feed. That was my understanding of it.
Yeah, that sounds quite horrible, actually.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway.
Anyways, so today, I was reading, or not today, but I was recently reading a well-written blog post, I guess, it tackles a topic that you've spoken about in the past.
Yeah, I think I know where you're going with this. Yep.
Yeah, it's a post called It's Time to Let JavaScript Go. Right. So in the past, we've asked the question, has JavaScript outstayed its welcome? But this post, written by none other than yourself, is basically asserting the fact that, yes, it has overstayed its welcome and we need to send it off to the farm.
That's right. Yeah. We've spoken about it a fair bit before. We did a whole episode on it. We have asked the question somewhat politely before, has it outstayed its welcome? And yes, this time I think I'm saying it's enough. It's enough. Like, we can't pretend that this is even a legitimate question anymore. It has. We all know it has. For our own safety and our own sanity and our own sake, we have to let it go. We have to move on. And I'll tell you how this came about, right? So over the course of the last 2-3 months, there has been a barrage, an onslaught of supply chain attacks in the JavaScript ecosystem, particularly in NPM, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about what that means and what the significance of it is a bit. And I spoke about this a bit in my post as well. But there was one that kicked it off earlier this year with that AI product that we spoke about earlier on an earlier episode.
Mm-hmm.
There was the Shai-Hulud worm. Then there was this Next.js thing. It just goes on and on and on. And how this line of thinking came about was, I was looking into it and I was thinking, I was asking myself, why does this keep happening? Is it because NPM is just that much more ubiquitous? Like, is it the same as, why are there more viruses on Windows than there are on Linux and Mac OS? Is it because Windows is more vulnerable or less secure? Or is it just because Windows is more prolific, therefore that's what people target?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is a bit of both in that case. Windows is obviously much more secure now than it used to be. There are a lot of people that say you don't need antivirus anymore because Windows Defender is that good. But certainly it's unquestionable that malware authors have targeted Windows, because if you're going to put the effort into writing it, you want the biggest blast radius, right?
Yeah. If
you're absolutely not doing something targeted. So I was wondering, is this the case with NPM? And you know what? There's an element of that for sure, right? Like, you know, if you're going to go to the effort of trying to infiltrate a supply chain or trying to distribute some kind of malware or do something, NPM is a much more sensible target because it's just, there's so much more of it everywhere. But I started looking into it and I just started doing a little bit of research and I was wondering, is it more vulnerable? And what I found, yeah, honestly, it terrified me. NPM is terrifying. It's actually terrifying. And I speak about this in the post a bit as well. But it is, like, if you look at package management and package distribution infrastructure, in .NET, we've got NuGet, right?
Yep.
But there's other, you know, there's obviously all these other systems for all these other frameworks, you know, and I talk about some of this in the post as well. Like, there's obviously Maven for Android.
Yeah.
Well, not just Android. Yeah. And obviously there's Java, there's Go modules, RubyGems, Python, like all of these different platforms and systems have their own way of distributing packages, right? Because modern software is built on reusable libraries, whether those are open source or commercial or what have you. And they all need a distribution system.
Yeah, yeah.
And they all have their weaknesses and they're all vulnerable in some way or another. But NPM is horrifically vulnerable. Like, one of the most famous supply chain attacks that happened in the JavaScript ecosystem happened because, and this literally happened, right? I'm not making this up. And this wasn't even that long ago. This was like a couple of years ago. Someone found a popular package. Can't remember what it was. I should look this up. I should know. But someone found a popular package. It's the equivalent of, I'll tell you what, we're .NET devs. I'll give you the equivalent, right? It's the equivalent of someone publishing a NuGet package with the correct package ID that was newtonsoft.json and making the version 14.
How's that possible?
How is it possible? On .NET, on NuGet, it's not possible because you have namespace reservation.
Yeah.
On NPM, this was no such thing. And literally, no one had thought of it. And someone just found a popular package and just published a newer version. That's weakness number one, right?
Yep.
Weakness number two. In NuGet, you can specify your dependencies as requiring a version higher than or a version between or a version lower than, right?
Yep.
With NPM, when you, but sorry, but with NuGet, when you do that, that's, you're kind of saying this depends on this and requires this version. But you're not saying install a version higher than that. You still specify what version to install, right? There are obviously heuristics you can use. But in NPM, you in your package.json, you can actually say, I want a version higher than this. And you can, you know, you can use semantic versioning and you can specify minor, major, or patch or what have you.
Yeah.
But typically, what you do is you say, I want a version greater than this. So someone comes along and they release a version that is greater than that, that's the same package ID, because there was no package ID, right? It's just package names.
Yeah.
It okay. doesn't work the same way as with NuGet, right? So someone comes along, releases this version, publishes a version of a package, and everyone else that's got like the greater than indicator, they do a build or they do a restore or an install, and that's it. Like they've got it.
Yeah.
That's bad, right? It's worse. It gets worse, right? Well, I mean, I don't know if it gets worse. Like there's more. NPM has install lifecycle execution scripts. Lifecycle, right? Install lifecycle. So if you publish an NPM package, you can have scripts that execute pre-install, install, and post-install. So you can have arbitrary code that runs on someone's machine just from installing your package. Now, I do mention in my post that with NuGet it's a bit more protected. So like you can have MS build targets, right?
Yeah.
But you can't have MS build targets in your NuGet package that are executed arbitrarily.
And I'm trying to figure out what the use case for that is. Why would I need something to run a script on pre-install?
I'm speculating here, but because the package ecosystem with JavaScript and with NPM is such a mess, it's probably for validation. So yeah, I mean, look, the whole package ecosystem is a nightmare. Like even aside from the security, like just maintaining it is a pain in the ass. But like just getting back to this, the fact that it executes arbitrary code on install, not even on build, like not even on run, like on install. You can't do that in .NET. And like even with NuGet, I mentioned this in the post, but I kind of got it wrong because I'm thinking about it more. Like you can specify an MS build target in your NuGet package, but I still don't think that that's going to arbitrarily run. I don't think that an MS build target in a NuGet package is going to run just because it's specified there. I still think you have to call that in your CS proj file or in your, you know, in your build script. I'll have to double check that.
Yeah.
But even if it does run, like, I mean, it still removes it, but it's still not going to happen on install. You're still going to have to build it, which I don't know how much extra security that provides. I guess the difference is that you can install it and then inspect it, whereas with NPM, you can't. It's going to install and it's going to run.
That's what I was going to suggest. But I mean, reality, would you be inspecting every package?
No, and that's the problem. The other problem is that one of those MS build targets can be MPMI, right? So, and there are a lot of NuGet packages that do that, that require MPM, that require like node stuff, like any UI library, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like, if you think of your UI libraries that are running in your MVC or your Razor applications that are using things like Tailwind, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the other things that I spoke about as well. And I'm going off topic here a little bit. Well, I'm not going off topic, but I'm jumping ahead a bit. Is that this is how, you know, like one of the things that happened was that one of these vulnerabilities in NPM actually made the jump to, and I think it, which one was it? Was it the Next.js one? Or was it Shai-Hulud? I think it might have been Shai-Hulud. Where was it? It made the jump to Maven. Shai-Hulud made the jump to Maven. The phrase that I use here is zoonotic spillover. So, you know, like when that's when they talk about how like COVID, for example, started out as an animal virus and zoonotic spillover is when it starts making its way to other species and infects other things. That happened, right? Shai-Hulud made the jump from NPM to Maven. And that's how it happens. It is like, you know, even things outside the JavaScript ecosystem depend on them. like I said, you know, the example that I just gave is UI libraries, right?
Yeah.
It's terrifying. And, you know, like all of these things that we've just spoken about, and we're scratching the surface here, like the fact that there's no MFA, like anyone can publish a package, right? The fact that the other problem here is getting away from the security side of it, the maintenance side of it, the NPM ecosystem, like the package.json system, more importantly, the package lock. God damn, it's a nightmare. I've complained so many times on this show about having to do resolve merge conflicts with a package lock.json. It's just like, fucking kill me.
Yep.
It's so bad. And where I'm going with this is that the culture of how these packages are built is it's layered, but it's not just layered. It's like you're talking about like hundreds of layers deep of dependencies until you get to a point where you are dependent through like a dependency chain on some package that hasn't been updated for God knows how long, that's maintained by someone who you don't know who it is, who can, you know, change that at any time, publish a new version.
But see, that side of it's not unique to NPM or JavaScript, right? That's, I guess, any open source dependency will suffer that or is susceptible to that lack of maintenance, that lack of hygiene.
Yes, that's not unique to NPM, but the what is different, what is unique to NPM is the culture of micro packages, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about .NET and NuGet, like, you know, most of what we build are quite robust libraries, and yes, they have dependencies, but you can conceivably manage it and have some governance around it because you can inspect it. But with NPM, the culture encourages micro packages. Yeah. So it's not just, you know, here's your dependencies and here's your dependencies of your dependencies and so on and so forth. It's thousands and thousands of tiny little, like even just like what you might call utility classes, like published as a little package. Right?
Yeah. I mean, you look at your node modules directory.
Yeah. I try not to because it's exactly what I'm saying. It's like, even aside from the security, like it's a nightmare.
Yeah. You do one NPM install and all of a sudden you've taken up 3 gig of...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
In your node modules directory. Yeah, I get that.
So yes, it's pretty bad, right? It's pretty bad. So from a security perspective, from a governance perspective, and again, like we're barely scratching the surface here.
But is this a JavaScript problem or is this an NPM problem?
The two are inseparable. There is no other package management for JavaScript. Not only that, well, actually, sorry, there is, right? There's PNMP and there's Yarn and there's other things like that, but they're built on top of NPM. They're not replacements for it. They're wrappers for it.
Yeah, okay.
Right? On top of that, you know, you can't bring something else now into the JavaScript ecosystem without breaking everything. And this is a big part of the problem. And this is kind of where I'm going with this being not just an NPM problem. Okay? So first of all, they are inseparable. But second of all, it's a culture problem, right? So one of the things that I've mentioned before is the culture around JavaScript. And it's something that we spoke about last night when we were talking about startup culture.
Yeah.
Right? The culture of JavaScript is, and certainly has been at least for the last 10 years, it encourages slop, right? It's a culture that is built on iterating fast, shipping things that don't work and worrying about fixing them later and then moving on to the next thing. And it's not just about tech debt. It's not just about, let's ship this. We know we've got this problem. We'll check it later. It's about, let's ship this and we're not even going to test it. Like, you know, if there are bugs in it, we'll let the users find them. And if that they turn out to be problems, then we might fix them. And I like, obviously that is extreme and that's not the whole of JavaScript, but that is the JavaScript culture. And the problem with culture, and this again, it's like what we spoke about with Git, right? Not everyone who uses Git, and actually Linux is a great example, right? So the culture of Linux was driven largely by Linus Torvalds, and he had a particular attitude and personality, and that pervaded the culture and the ecosystem for decades. And it's changed a bit, and he has changed a bit as well, right? So cultures can change. Cultures do change. But I don't see that happening with JavaScript, and actually I don't think it can, right? I mean, if you think about everything that we spoke about yesterday, particularly with your enterprise governance and your clients that have the need for robust, rigorous governance, and you know, you need to be able to go to them and talk about why should we trust that you have done due diligence in evaluating this code, checking this code, red teaming it, securing it, so on and so forth. Like with JavaScript, you can't. Like you just can't. And like even secure JavaScript applications are not secure.
Yeah.
Nor can they be. And again, like the problem is the culture. And like the reason that I think JavaScript is a bit different from Linux or anything else in terms of why it won't change. I mean, one of the problems is that one of the rules of JavaScript is that you can't break it. You can't break the web. It's always got to be 100% backwards compatible. We've mentioned this before as well. I think I brought this up once when saying that, like your browser now has to successfully run and execute ECMAScript that was written in 1995. It literally has tech debt built in.
Interesting. So there's a few things I want to pull apart here, dig into. Yeah. I'll start there, right?
And sorry, I'll just say that I'm pausing here because I'm far from done.
I just found an opportunity for me to actually say something while you took a breath. Okay, on that, I get why we need the backwards compatibility. All right, you listen to Scott Hanselman and he'll say the same thing about Windows, that, you know, applications from Windows 3.1 will still run today, right?
Will they?
Well, maybe it's .NET, maybe not Windows, but .NET. Like, there's the reason why, like, there's a lot of effort put into backwards compatibility in the Microsoft ecosystem.
Yes, that's right? True. Yeah. Now, and there are a lot of people that will tell you that that is what's holding Microsoft back, but absolutely, that's a whole other conversation.
Absolutely. But okay, the point I want to make here is, why do we need that? Now, there's a difference between browser-based and Windows-based. That's why I wanted to bring it up, right? I get that you need backwards compatibility in the desktop Windows space, server space even, because there's enterprises out there that are running code bases that are quite old, that, you know, their entire business is built on, that it's serving their purpose and they're not going to start again from scratch, right?
Yeah.
I get that. But from a browser perspective, right, the whole point of the browsers is that they're evergreen now.
Right.
Right. We have evergreen browsers. They constantly update. They maintain all standards. But there's not, like, we're not using enterprise level line of business software straight out in the browser that doesn't depend on other aspects. Why can't we do exactly what we did with IE, or similar to what we did with IE, and just maybe start to, I guess, have a fork in the road or a divergence here, and say Chrome Classic works with JavaScript up to 2025, and the new versions of the browsers start from scratch, and we can get rid of that tech debt.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's a bit of an overlap, right? It's, you know, it's Chrome Classic works up to 2025, and then Chrome New works from 2023 onwards.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a few things to unpack there. First of all, I really don't even know where to start, right? So first of all, you could do that, but who's going to do that? Who's going to say that? Because, like, if you look at, I mean, it's JavaScript, it's ECMAScript, it's an open standard. Chrome doesn't own
it. It is.
Google don't own it.
No, they don't, but they can influence it.
Well, of course they can, right? So, but like
browser standards are influenced by the browser companies, the guys developing the browsers.
Okay. So what you're saying is, if Google say, we are no longer supporting these legacy features of the language from new versions of Chrome as of blah, 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 everyone's just going to have to deal with it.
No, everyone that needs those legacy APIs need to use a different, like a forked version of Chrome Classic.
Yeah, but it's not that simple, right? Because it's not like at some point people writing newer versions of applications stopped using those legacy APIs. Those legacy APIs are still there and they're not marked as obsolete or deprecated. People are using them. Like, it's not just people that have a need to support legacy applications. It's everyone refactoring their entire code bases to no longer use legacy APIs.
Yeah, I guess in my mind, what I was thinking was that the problematic legacy is basically considered obsolete and therefore no longer required. But as you've just stated, I mean, there's probably a lot of that legacy in there that's still used, and it's not just there for pure backwards compatibility.
That's exactly it. Yeah. And look, the problem is deeper, right? And the reason I say it's cultural, and the reason that I say it's deeply embedded within JavaScript itself is this, right? JavaScript is a scripting language, right? Mm-hmm. It was something that was added to browsers for convenience of a bit of DOM manipulation and later used for Ajax and now used for entire applications and, you know, not just in the browser, but entire government and defense and banking infrastructure built on JavaScript. And it's terrifying, right? Now, if you compare it to something like C Sharp, and again, I know I'm a C Sharp dev and I know I'm biased here, but if you want a different example, I'll give you a different example. I'm just using this one because I know it. If you look at something like C Sharp, it was built specifically based on the concept of the pit of success. It was built on this idea of there's a right way to do something, there's a good way to do something, and this language and this framework will make that the easiest way to do it, to encourage you to do things the right way.
Mm-hmm.
It's also built on a legacy of decades of computer science and object-oriented programming and architectural principles and software engineering principles, design patterns, all this sort of stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
You compare that to JavaScript, where JavaScript doesn't, not only does it not encourage any of that, but it actively encourages not doing that, right? JavaScript has always been about do whatever you like and do it in the easiest way possible.
Yeah.
Now, that's not to say that there aren't developers out there and there aren't organizations out there and there aren't teams out there that encourage rigorous coding standards. There are, but it's not part of the culture of the language and it's not part of the culture of the platform. And the culture of the platform actively encourages against it. And that is my problem. And like, to give you some examples, you know, everything that I just said about C Sharp or object-oriented programming in general. And again, I'm not saying object-oriented programming is the right model for everything. You know, it's not. I'm very interested in doing more functional programming. And, mm-hmm. you know, I've got some whole things that I want to do around that. But the point is, it's built on software engineering principles based on decades and decades of research and learning and everything. If you look at JavaScript, or you look at quote unquote front end in general, it's spent the last 10 years rediscovering software engineering principles that back-end software engineers have known for decades.
Yeah.
And I'm not making this up. I'm not taking the piss. This is literally true, right?
Yeah.
And to give one example, and I know it's a joke, but it's not a joke because it really happened. But if you look at that that picture that went around, I don't know, a couple of years ago from like React Conf or wherever it was, it was Next.js, right? Where someone showed like at this conference of this new version, they're saying, look, you can have your SQL queries directly in your UI. And I know Scott Hanselman and a few other people shared that and, you know, were laughing about it. But do you know what I mean? Like, it's funny, but like, this is what the entire world's infrastructure is built on. Yeah. And this is the culture that's there. And like, you know, the point where I'm going with this is like anything that whatever you just said about, can we get rid of the legacy? Yeah, we probably can. And like anything else that we can do? Yeah, we probably can. Yeah, we probably can. But we're still talking about dragging something, kicking and screaming out of the culture and out of what it was built for, which was encouraging convenience and speed, right? Over robust, rigorous engineering.
Okay. Next point I want to dig in on, and it's something you've mentioned countless times. I've lost track. I tried to count, but I lost track. The word culture.
Yeah.
Now, any organization, any team, be it sport or business, any school, family, anything else, right?
Yeah.
What defines the culture? Where does the culture come from?
That is a whole conversation in itself, right?
It is, but at a high level.
It comes from the loudest people.
Does it? It comes from the top.
Yes and no.
Well, if it comes from the loudest people, it's because the people at the top are letting them.
Well, there's a whole other thing to explore here, but the loudest people are the ones that claw their way to the top.
Yeah, okay. But ultimately, the point I'm trying to get at here is it's the leadership at the top that define the culture.
Yeah.
Right? If they're not happy with the loudest people steering it the wrong way, they're going to say something because they want the culture of their organization to be a certain thing.
Yeah.
Okay? So ultimately, the culture comes from the top. They're the ones that are steering it. They might not be the ones influencing it. They might not be the ones actually driving that culture, but they're absolutely the ones that are responsible for it and making sure that it stays true to their vision and true to what they want from the organization.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the culture of Linux.
Yeah.
Was heavily influenced by Linus's personal opinions.
Yeah.
Again, it's come from the top.
Yeah.
The culture of .NET, C#. Has come from the top. It's come from Microsoft.
Yeah.
Who's at the top of JavaScript?
Well, that's the thing is no one.
That's my point. That's the point I want to get to here is there is no one at the top. There is no one steering that culture. And because there is no one steering that culture, it is doing exactly what you're suggesting, where it's the loudest people are now driving that culture.
Yeah.
And it's not a, like there's no deliberate steering, no deliberate guidance of what that culture should be or where it should be going.
Yeah.
And therefore it is purely, I guess, it's anarchy, right?
Yeah.
When there is no one at the top steering it, like that's the ecosystem itself is driving that culture and it's coming from within.
Absolutely. And this is something that I said in my post here.
So I just wanted to dig on that because like I found it quite interesting. You keep mentioning that word culture, and then you did mention, you know, the culture of Linux was driven, may not have been driven by Linus, but he certainly helped steer it.
Yeah.
Right. And I think it's just one of those things that we need to recognize the fact that there is no one actually taking control of that cultural direction.
That's
of
right.
The JavaScript ecosystem.
That's right. And that's like, that's what allowed and enabled JavaScript to be so successful. And that's how it got where it is. And that's also why you can't put that genie back in that bottle, right? I think the phrase that I use somewhere here, if I can find it, is that JavaScript's greatest strength is all of its greatest weaknesses. Like the thing that allowed it to become what it is the thing that's holding it back. And that's why I say that you can't change the culture. Look, JavaScript can change, JavaScript can evolve, and it could become something different. But without becoming something so fundamentally unrecognizable from what it is today, it's not going to make a difference, which is what leads me to my conclusion of why bother? Like,
just take it out to pasture,
let it rest. Yeah, yeah. It's interesting because I wrote this post. As I said, I just did a bit of I started off out of curiosity, wondering, why does this keep happening to NPM? And then I started digging into it, and then I started digging into more. And that's when I eventually ended up with this post. And I didn't promote it. I didn't share it. I shared it internally at work, and I was wondering, well, what people thought. And people broadly agreed, but, you know, I didn't promote it or share it online. I did end up sharing it in response to a comment on a post on LinkedIn a week or so ago.
Yeah.
And I got some reactions from people. And I got one comment on the blog post, which is from a friend of mine, from someone that I've known for about 10 years, and he is a full-time JavaScript developer, and he has worked at some very, he worked at Facebook at one point, right? And it's just interesting reading his comment. And, his view is that as someone who loves JavaScript and works on it full-time and has done for over a decade, he's kind of, I can't really argue against anything you're saying here.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Like I said, it's like, you know, I am biased, and I'm a .NET dev. But like I mentioned here, like, you know, if someone were to tell me all of this about .NET and about C#, it's like, well, I'd be gutted because I love it, but I would have to move on.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, and something else I mentioned here is, you know, I've lived through that heartbreak before. You know, I guess I'm more positioned to be accustomed to just moving on if I have to, you know. Beano, Amiga, you know, Windows Phone. I love those things.
Oh, and let me guess, you had the Betamax.
Betamax. No, I didn't. That was that was before my time. Actually, no, it's funny. I remember renting movies as a kid from the video shop, and you'd put it in and there'd be the thing at the start of it. I can't remember what it was about, but it was like, if you've rented this cassette on Betamax, blah, 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 or if you've rented it on VHS, blah, blah, blah. And I can't remember what those announcements were at the start of those videos, but that's my recollection of Betamax.
I don't remember those ones, but yeah, no. Interesting. So where does that leave us? Right. We know, let's assume we're agreeing that it is time.
Yeah.
It is time to let JavaScript rest.
Yeah.
And I think I know the answers here, but based on our last conversation about this, but what's the alternative? Like, where do we go from here?
I think one thing that I have to be very clear about is JavaScript isn't going away ever.
No, right? It's not, but we don't need to be part of the ecosystem. Well, sorry, let me change that. We should be in a position where we can choose not to be part of that ecosystem.
Yeah.
And if we're building new applications and tools, and if we want to move away and we don't want to be left vulnerable in the JavaScript world, what are our options there?
Well, the reality is right now, none. Well, actually, okay, let me put it another way. There's the only way that we could possibly get away from JavaScript right now is to not build browser applications, because there's nothing realistically that we can use to build applications that will run in the browser other than JavaScript right now.
Yeah.
That's not to say that things aren't coming, but like, you know, we're .NET devs, we could do Blazor, right? But Blazor still has JavaScript dependencies. Even if you don't write your own JS interop code, Blazor itself has JavaScript dependencies.
Yeah.
Right. There are other WASM or WebAssembly based frameworks out there. I don't know them well enough to say here is one that has no JavaScript reliance at all. I just don't know that. But I do believe that's where we are going. And that is something that I have said before on an episode. You know, we looked at Dylan Beatty's talk about WASM and about what the opportunities are to change the nature of open source in the future.
Yep.
I think that's a really interesting talk that everyone should watch. But I do think WASM will change things. And, you know, we're already seeing people experiment with it and building some really cool stuff based on WASM. It's not kind of broad enough and generalized enough or ubiquitous enough yet that I could go to a client and say, we're going to choose this for your next UI.
Yeah.
But I do think it's coming. And there are signs of it. I also think that because of the nature of WASM, you know, I think the thing that will change is I don't think we're going to see this is the new JavaScript. This is something that is going to unseat JavaScript. I think we're going to see a proliferation of choice that we don't have right now. I think people are going to build different WASM things. And maybe you'll be able to patchwork them together. I don't know. And I don't know whether that would be a good thing or a sensible thing or not. But yeah, I think the nature of the web and the nature of the browser is changing. What we don't have, and this is the major blocker right now, is we don't have anything that can interact with the DOM except JavaScript.
Long live jQuery.
What's wrong with jQuery? I love jQuery.
Long live jQuery.
Oh yeah, long live jQuery. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But yeah, like right now there's no API in the browser for interacting with the DOM other than JavaScript. So, and the problem is, you know, we're talking about enterprise applications here, but for, you know, quote unquote the web, we can't get rid of the DOM. We can't get rid of HTML. Like, you know, we can't get rid of the web. So until there's an API that lets you interact with that, JavaScript is not going anywhere. I guess the question is, in a nearer term, should we be looking to WASM-based alternatives for enterprise application development? Obviously, that's a very firm yes from me. But yeah, no, we're not there yet. And I'm not saying we are. I just, that's what I think is where we're going to go here. And, you know, it's like, the other thing is just thinking back to what Scott said when we brought Scott on to talk about Grace.
Yep.
It's the same scenario, you know, the picture that he painted there is, you know, Git isn't going anywhere. And even if Grace wins, so to speak, it's not going to just come along overnight and people are going to switch off Git. It's going to be slow. And even when it becomes dominant, you know, Git will still be there.
Yeah.
And that's what happened with JavaScript is, you know, JavaScript. And I don't think something else is going to come along that's going to replace JavaScript. Like, so what Scott was saying is that, and also actually back to your point as well, right? When you were asking me earlier about when we were talking about, can we change it? Can we improve it? Yeah, he spoke about other tools that have come along as wrappers around Git, and he spoke about other things that just a little bit different. And none of those are ever really gonna unseat it off the top spot. You need something that's fundamentally different enough to make it worthwhile for people to change.
Yeah, but I mean, even if it is a wrapper, you've got the underlying problems and the underlying faults, right? They don't go away. You might mask them and you might hide them, but they don't go away.
Exactly. And that's what he was saying. And that's what I was saying at the start of this about NPM alternatives, right?
Yeah.
It's the same situation. But I think the difference is I don't think that there's going to be something else that comes along and slowly replaces JavaScript as a dominant framework. And I may be wrong. But I just think that eventually there will be so many things that JavaScript will no longer be the dominant framework because there will be no dominant framework.
But
that's what I think.
Yeah.
And again, it could be wrong, right?
If and when that day comes, if JavaScript hasn't evolved and adapted and solved the problems that you've spoken of, then they will fall behind the wayside.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yes, that's what I think will happen.
I wonder, though, all that is predicated on the assumption that the browser is going to be the entry point to, or the UI of choice for consumers.
Yeah.
Right. Is that a safe assumption these days?
Yes.
Because I know I've heard Yuli say, and you know, this was way back, 5-6 years ago now, he was saying back then, like voice assistants were the new UI, right? So relative early days of, say, Siri and Google Assistant and whatnot, but, you know, not right at the very beginning, but basically interacting with the systems using your voice.
Yeah.
We've got, obviously, mobile phones. They've been prevalent for many years now. But is the browser going to be the default UI for consumers?
For the foreseeable future, yes. Yeah. I mean, look, natural interaction systems, it's not just voice, but it's, you know, spatial computing, for example, as well. You know, sight, vision, touch, all these things. Yeah. I mean, the thing about the browser is that it's a standardized cross-platform delivery mechanism for applications, and all these other things aren't. So, like, for example, you know, if you want to say, I want my application to be voice enabled, well, right now you have to either do that through the browser or you have to do it through operating system hooks.
Yep.
So is voice, I mean, yeah, and like, this is the thing, is like voice interaction, like what actually is that? It's actually just speech to text.
Yeah.
And then text interaction. And right now that happens via a browser, right? Or it happens at least via an HTTP interface, an HTTP API in most cases. Actually, not all, you know, I mean, even if it uses something like gRPC or WebSockets, it's still encapsulated over an HTTP2 interface. So I don't know, like, is the browser going to remain the dominant interaction framework? Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. Will something eventually replace it? Maybe. I don't think voice interaction qualifies as the new UI in that sense. I think a better way of phrasing it is it's the new UX.
Yeah, look, I mean, that was just one example, but just thinking, right? Like, is there a future where, I guess, browsers specifically, back to what they used to be, or served for what they used to be, which was more commercial applications, more brochure-type websites, maybe research, but the actual enterprise-level applications and whatnot that are now finding their way in the browser actually make their way back to the desktop or mobile devices?
The problem with that is that I was thinking about this in another context as well, in the context of something else you said in our conversation yesterday. So something you said yesterday was that if your revenue depends on a platform, you are at the whim of that platform.
Yes.
So you were talking about, I guess, mobile apps, Android or
yeah, or iOS. As an example, but right, as an example, back in the day, yeah, when Facebook opened up their API and
that's what
Facebook apps, there were businesses that were built on that. And then all of a sudden Facebook shut their API down and those businesses either evolve or they die.
That's right. And that's how that conversation came about. But then I think we extrapolated it into the kind of app store ecosystem type thing. The other example that we've brought up before is Getflix, because that one always makes me laugh.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, but I think the reason I'm going to the app store with this is, like, let's say we're not using the browser anymore, right? Let's say we're talking about native apps, whether that's desktop or mobile or what have you, right? Currently, those things are gate kept by Apple and Google.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas with the web, they're not. The web is, quote unquote, bunny is open, right?
Yeah.
So if you build an application or a platform or a product and it's deliverable via an open cross-platform mechanism, that de-risks you compared to something that is delivered via a gate-kept walled garden that's controlled by Apple or Google, that they could at any point decide they're no longer allowing you to list or sell your app anymore. It's not even about like the 30% fee, right? It's about the fact that they might say, actually, screw you. You're not distributing your app here anymore. That is a massive, massive antitrust issue. It's a whole other conversation. Like, it's beyond the 30% fee thing, which has been an ongoing issue with like Epic Games, for example, right?
Mm.
But, you know, like with Android, for example, you can sideload applications out of the box.
You can, but you need to know what you're doing, right? If you're a business and, or if I'm running a business and I've purchased an CRM application from another company, and rather than using their website, if they have to download and install their custom app on the phone, you're going to ask all of your employees to sideload an application?
No, as a business, it's a much easier, it's a solved problem, right? As a business, you use an MDM.
Yeah.
And you just assign it. They just enroll and they get it. That's the easy part, right? And that will work on Apple and Android, right? The difficult thing is if your customers are consumers and you want them to install your app, right? With Android, it's actually very easy. You can just go to a website and you can do it via a website, right? But with Apple, it's not possible without jailbreaking your device. And the question here is, as a computing platform, which is what iOS is, it's an operating system.
Mm.
Is it or is it not okay for Apple to say, we will control what software you can and cannot install on your operating system? I don't think it's a question we're going to answer now, but that is ultimately the problem. Now, of course, the argument is that iOS is more trustworthy because Apple vet all of the apps that are available, and therefore you can trust that an app you install via the App Store is safe. And in fairness, I don't know of any, and I could be wrong, and I'm not saying this with certainty, but I don't know of any malware that has been distributed via the App Store. I'm not saying that hasn't happened.
Mm.
I'm just saying I just can't think of any right now, but I can think of multiple instances of malware being distributed via the Google Play Store.
Yeah. And I guess that's the argument there. But to answer your question, whether or not as an operating system, is it their right to be able to dictate what can and cannot be installed? I think to me, as a consumer, that's part of the decision-making process when it comes to what operating system am I going to install? Yep. What ecosystem do I want to be a part of?
Yeah.
Right. That's part of that consumer decision. So my opinion is, yes, they're allowed to do that. The fact is, I don't use Apple products for that reason.
Yeah.
I want a bit more freedom. I don't want them to tell me what I can and cannot install.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. As a consumer, that's your right. That's your choice. As an antitrust regulator, I'm not sure it's that cut and dry, but I'm not an antitrust regulator, so I don't know. But anyway, we're kind of getting away from the question that you asked here, which is the browser going to go away? And until that problem is solved, the answer is no, right?
Yeah.
And even if we solve that problem and you can have a way where you can go to a website and you can download and install an application, you still need to go to the website to download and install the application.
Yeah, but then that website doesn't need to be JavaScript, is my point.
Yeah, true.
Right. So my point, it's not necessarily is the browser going away, but it's is the browser still going to be the dominant UI delivery
for applications.
Yes, application delivery mechanism, right?
Yeah.
And because if it's not, like if the applications that we're building move away from the browser, then no, we don't need to rely on JavaScript.
Well, yeah. But I mean, WASM gives us that. We just don't have the UI framework built on WASM yet, right? Because this is the thing is it requires someone to build an entire UI paradigm. Like right now we have the DOM and right now WASM can't directly manipulate the DOM. So we need JavaScript. So the only way we're getting away from that is for someone to say, I'm going to build a bespoke UI that runs on WASM that doesn't use the DOM. And that will happen. It's just going to take a while.
And you're looking for a side project?
Not me. No, thank you. I have enough of those. So yeah, I don't know if I've convinced you.
Oh, I'm convinced.
Yeah.
I'm convinced. I really don't like JavaScript. I'm not a fan of the UI frameworks, but then again, you know, I'm not really a big fan of, not a big UI designer developer.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know me, right? If we could be doing WPF and XAML inside, I guess the browser, or even just make it more relevant these days, I'd be so much more happier.
Well, we can. That's what Silverlight's for. Oh.
And on that bombshell. Okay. Well, it is only 10 o'clock in the morning, so I don't know if they're hauling last drinks right now, but I'm pretty sure.
Much like JavaScript, this conversation has long outstayed its welcome.
It has. But I was going to say, I think they're calling last drinks on 2025.
They really are, actually. Yeah, that's it. That's true.
Yeah. There's not many hours left in 2025. So looking forward to the new year, Matt. Looking forward to catching up in February with yourself and all of our listeners in Sydney.
Yep.
And anyone that wants to travel up or up and down into Sydney to catch up, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, we need to create an official event page so people can start registering.
Yep.
You want to
get the AI slop onto that to build up a JavaScript app for us.
Yeah, sounds good. All right. Thanks, Liam. It's been a good chat. It's been a good year. Looking forward to next year. But for now, I think that's it for this episode of the Beer Driven Devs. I'm Matt Goldman.
And I'm Liam Elliott. Cheers.
Cheers.
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.
All right, I'm going to stop the recording.
Wait. Okay, so